Or what was the difference, you know?
The difference was they were willing to do whatever they needed to do
okay.
to secure the sponsors, to fulfill their dreams. And I found that my I didn't have the willingness to do whatever it took to, I didn't want to play the game.
That's the voice of 3-time women's longboard world champion, Cori Schumacher. Cori has made headlines both in and out of the surf industry multiple times over the past 15 years for repeatedly walking away from surfing after securing its highest prize.
Lady Ned, come to me in here, tell me I'm alone.
In fact, I saw them at the Surfers Pull Award and, you know, got pulled off to the side by one of them and, you know, where did you go? And I'm like, and she was crying. She didn't get the Rookie of the Year. And I looked at her. I was like, because I don't want to put up with any of this. Like, what is this?
Right.
What is this value system? Like, what does this mean? Mm-hmm. So I'd already jumped to the place where I was realizing that none of it meant anything. You couldn't do anything with what you were getting out of surfing. There was a larger world out there, and I wanted to know what it was.
Welcome to Surf Splendor. I'm your host, David Scales. In today's episode, I have a candid conversation about the current state of women's surfing with Cori Schumacher.
I basically was born, I was born on California Street in Huntington, so literally blocks from the beach at home. And both my parents surfed, they met out at Newport Jetties. So pretty much right from the moment that I was outside, I was at the beach.
Wow.
My dad would kind of balance me on the surfboard, and would take me out. I'd hold onto his back and he'd just kick out some like huge, when we moved down to Ocean Beach, San Diego, huge days out at Ocean Beach. And just, he taught me to hold my breath to go under and
wow.
would ride with me on his back. And then at the age of 5, I finally got like my first surfboard, and it was a softboard, and I rode that out at Dog Beach and Ocean Beach for the first time at
awesome.
5. So that was kind of like my first real day of surfing, and I was boogie boarding and stuff before that.
Yeah.
I had always longboarded and shortboarded. I mean, I throughout the entire time that I surfed.
Yeah.
I did the club coalition contests. Surfed in contests against my mom, longboarding. In fact, I actually had two events in Huntington at Golden West and on the north side of the Huntington Pier. One was a USSF, and then one was a coalition contest, a PLA.
Okay.
Actually, it was a PLA. So one longboard and one shortboard, same weekend. And I had a friend drive me back and forth and I ended up winning both.
No way.
Yeah. So. And there was a point at which my parents were like, all right, you're going to have to make a decision here.
Yeah.
You know? But so for me, I'd always done it. But because there was no future in longboarding,
okay.
I really had, if I wanted to be a competitive surfer, I had to do the shortboard thing.
No competitive future? No professional future?
There was no professional future in longboarding and up until 1999,
okay.
when the very first Women's World Longboard Championship run, that wasn't through the ASP. It was only in 2005 that the ASP came on board with the Women's Longboarding Championship. So at that point in my surfing career, if I wanted to be a professional surfer, I had to go.
Shortboard.
I had to. If I wanted to win a world title, which I did,
yeah.
I had to go in that direction. Like I want
to be alone. Right out of high school, Cori set out on the Women's World Tour alongside Lisa Anderson, Rochelle Ballard, Megan Abubo, and Serena Brooke. Less than halfway through the season, her sponsorship dollars ran dry, and she was financially relegated to competing in only U.S. events. So she decided to take a break from surfing and relocate to San Francisco to pursue college.
Then what ended up happening is in 99, the very first Women's World Longboarding Championship came about.
Yeah.
So I had been disillusioned with the shortboarding thing, and I was like, you know, I not only with the sponsorships, but also just the fact of what was asked, my experience on the tour itself,
mm-hmm.
and what was asked of us by judges, by the ASP, by sponsors. Mm. The experience was awful. So that's why it was like, I'm going to commit myself to being somewhere that I really don't want to. Or
sure.
So my mom called me after the semester was through up in San Francisco, hadn't been surfing for a year at all. and said, hey, guess what? The very first Women's World Longboard Championship is going to be held in Costa Rica at Boca Barranca, first one in like 60 years. You got to be there. And I agreed. So I moved back home to here, went over to the contest. And so it was 10 days after I came back here, surfed for, you know, like 10 days, went over there and I got second place.
After only surfing for 10 days, after a year hiatus, basically.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah, it was pretty fun.
Yeah, no kidding.
Yeah. So I still had like my black hair and I went in the complete opposite direction.
Sure.
Yeah.
Which is kind of good, I think, at times, you know, to revitalize an artistic expression.
It was important for me because I had been trying to live into an ideal that I wasn't.
Yeah.
Because I had tried to construct myself in order, an image of myself in order for the sponsors and the surf industry and competitive surfing to
Let's unpack that a little bit.
Sure.
I think there's two things I'd like to unpack, actually. Kind of shortboard versus longboards, I think, is just worth discussing all in and of itself.
Yeah.
Just that transition that you kind of make over time into riding different equipment. But more kind of to the point that you're bringing up of just personally what you felt the industry was asking of you. What were they asking of you?
Yeah.
What were the, professional roles available to you at the time to play? And what were they, did you feel they were asking of you?
Okay. Well, I'll start with the first question. Because longboarding was not attached to money, and because it wasn't, it didn't have all of the bells and whistles that came with the ASP and anything like that, there was a community of people that was really like family. And the reason that I went to the event was not only to want to win the world championship, but it was also because this was a core group of women that I had grown up with, and I wanted to be a part of it, a part of their movement, a part of the next step for women's longboarding because it was family, and that had a lot to do with it. As far as the industry goes and what was required of me, back when I was doing the events, I was an amateur before the Roxy brand actually was even kind of like went live with the board short. The very first year that I went on tour was the year that Lisa Anderson was on the cover of Surfer magazine. I was actually in that magazine.
Okay. Yeah, like 94?
It was
maybe?
94, 95.
Okay.
But I was in that magazine as like the up and coming girl from California, the quintessential surfer girl.
Yeah.
That whole thing. And the quintessential surfer girl was blonde, blue eyes, you know, thin, feminine, the whole thing.
Was that Surfer Magazine's title on the piece or something?
No, it wasn't.
Girl,
it was in the text.
Yeah. Gotcha.
It was in the text. It was like, you know, she's the quintessential surfer girl,
gotcha.
California surfer girl. And that was, you know, they had like the up and coming.
Right.
It was like
right.
Yeah, the grommets and stuff. So as far as image, absolutely had to be feminine. It was made very clear to me, both in my surfing community, family, and in the industry, or the sponsors, that it was really important for me to come off as a heterosexual, basically just stay away from the lesbians, and make sure that I was fit, which then meant thin.
Sure.
It doesn't mean fit as in, that whole change of fit meaning muscular and strong was something that happened in the early 2000s when training really started to become a core part of surfing. The athletes started to treat themselves like athletes. And so thin, smiling all the time, make sure that you're smiling when you're surfing, which I was never good at. I was really too engaged with surfing to remember, oh, I've got a smile here. I think that the part that was really like the most frustrating was always trying to make sure that you had a boyfriend or you were like that whole heterosexual thing.
Yeah.
The whole not being perceived, not even being hinted at, hanging with the wrong people because that would end your career.
Hmm.
And that time they weren't putting a lot of women in the magazines, so it wasn't like you paddle out in a bathing suit in order to try to get a camera shot because the cameras they didn't care.
Sure.
So, but there was still that, okay, you know, make sure that you're friends with the photographers, go wherever they want to. So there was always that chasing of the photographer. And I didn't like that. I really, I didn't, I don't like, I still don't.
Right. Which isn't, male versus female thing. I mean, that's the same for all male surfers as well. Did you feel like, just in terms of your sheer ability and talent alone, that you were being neglected by the industry? Like, was your surfing on par with a lot of other males at that time? And you felt like you weren't getting your fair share of, you know?
At that time, it was, well, first, let me go back to 1990s was when the photographers started to ask a lot of girls to not wear bathing suits, or sorry, not wear wetsuits.
Gotcha.
So that started right at the very time that I was like, all right, I'm out of here. I don't want anybody telling me, you know, that I can't wear a wetsuit and also that I can't put sunscreen on because then it was white and they didn't want the women to actually have white. They wanted them to look
tan.
Yeah, the photos. And then as far as not being, as far as being on par with the guys,
that was consistent.
That's been consistent, where you're always as a woman measured against the men,
as a
how you're valued. Then I didn't question it. As far as my surfing ability, I was on par with a lot of the kids in my area that were my age. I wasn't even thinking, oh, I'm not getting as much as the guys. It was, I can't even make a living doing this.
Sure. But were the guys making the living at that time?
Yeah.
The equivalent boy
Absolutely.
Surfers?
Absolutely. Yeah. Okay. And then as far as longboarding, I was as good as the guys.
Sure.
Yeah.
Were the male longboarders making a living at that time?
Not really.
Right.
Yeah.
In longboarding in general, it's more difficult to make a living.
Yeah. But there was that transition time where they started to make a really good living at it.
Okay.
Yeah. But the guys were always the emphasis.
Okay.
Yeah, or the focus. But back then, I didn't question. I knew that I was less than. I just accepted it. I accepted that I was less than, that I was a part of a group of marginalized people that nobody really gave a crap about. And the burden to try to, every time I paddled out or, at a contest, to try to do the best that I could was always, it wasn't always just about me. It was about trying to make women's surfing look like it should be accepted and promoted and valued by the industry.
Corey won two longboard world championship titles in 2000 and 2001. She began experiencing some of the same feelings of dissatisfaction that she experienced in the late 90s, so she walked away from competition once again. This time, it was for 7 years.
What did you do during those 7 years off?
Wrote a lot.
Okay.
Yeah, that was my... What I figured out, I've always written. I guess if you were really to ask me, like, what did I want to do when I was young,
right.
I wanted to be a writer.
Okay.
So that was just as important to me as surfing. And something that I held very close to myself because I had this other thing that kind of got butchered by sharing it with everybody. So during those 7 years, I worked and wrote a lot. And wrote in order to get into the core of who I was.
Okay.
To try to, again, who am I? And I felt that writing was the key to open the door that separated the true me from me. And what ended up happening was, at the end of it all, in 2005, I realized that what I needed to do to get into that space to try, because I thought that there was like a little Corey in there that was sort of like already, oh, she's been probably like grown up in there, and like I could just walk in and go, oh, hello, I'm just going to introduce myself, and who are you, and tell me all about you. What ended up happening is I burned everything that I had written, and during that it was about 25,000 pages worth of things that I had written, and the door blew open, I walked in, there was nobody there, and I realized that I needed to be the one to fill that space. And that was a moment where it was like the moment that I've been waiting for so long, since I realized that there was something shrinking inside of me.
Mm-hmm.
And over the next several years, I worked up to the point where I was like, I'm going to win a world championship for me. I'm going to do it my way. No sponsors. I'm not going to have anybody telling me what to do, how to be, what to look like, how to fit in. I'm going to use my voice to try to shift things so that women don't ever have to go through this again.
Mm-hmm.
And that's pretty much what I've been doing ever since.
Hmm.
I didn't realize that the event in that the event that was going to be right after my world championship was going to be held in China, but that became the very first time that I openly spoke my truth.
Corey's referring to her decision to boycott the Women's Longboard Champion event in China in 2011 due to the country's human rights record. It kind of gets glossed over in our conversation here, but this was after she returned to competition to win her third world title in 2010.
And prior to that, I'd been an activist marching against, I was a part of the formation of the San Diego Peace and Justice Coalition right after 9/11 happened. And we went marching down the streets protesting invading Afghanistan. So mm-hmm. The activist in me was always there, but there was a separation.
When you were winning the world titles in the early 2000s, were you out at
that
time?
No, I didn't know.
Okay.
Until pretty much, well, no, I was. I'm sorry. I was not out until the New York Times article.
Okay.
After my boycott of China.
Oh, really? I didn't know that. I thought you were out previous to that.
No, my parents knew, and maybe there were some comments about what I was doing, but
it wasn't like open
industry.
I
didn't make it. I didn't say anything. No.
So part of that, is that what you're alluding to with part of that kind of burning the 25,000 pages and coming to that realization?
No, that actually didn't have to do with my sexuality. It had to do with being afraid of being myself. And part of that was my sexuality.
Sure.
But there's a lot in addition to that.
Yeah. Just a side note, have you ever regretted burning all those pages?
No.
You haven't?
No.
Because the catharsis was worth...
The being able to find my voice. I didn't have a voice until then.
Yeah.
All of my truth was kept hidden.
Yeah.
So that was the moment that I showed up for myself with a voice.
Tell me about that kind of moving forward after 2005. What did it look like in application and practice?
What it looked like was, first, extraordinarily humbling. I didn't have any masks to prop myself up, make myself feel good. It didn't matter that I was a world champion two times over. It didn't matter that I was anything anymore because I had reached sort of an infant stage as far as, okay, well, let's start from scratch. Let's
rebuilding.
Yeah, exactly. And again, you burn, if you've invested all of your time and your effort and your truth into, you know, a 3.5 foot pile of almost your size books, then when you burn it, you have no choice but to create a life of action, and so that's what I did. I just started from scratch and started to rebuild, not based upon anybody or anything that I'd done prior. My love of surfing and my need for being in the ocean was 1,000-fold stronger.
Really?
Because it was my relationship to the ocean that was the one thing that stayed consistent. And I recognized that it was a place not for me needing to feel stressed or anxious, but it was a space that was actually where my heart had always been. And me walking away from that had been walking also away from a core part of my health, my identity, the whole thing. So that became something that was really important. And then just pulling myself back up to health. I had, to be perfectly honest with you, I had a very lovely and long love affair with all kinds of whiskey and alcohol and partying and pulling myself away from those addictions and learning to get clear again was a big part of the post-2005 experience.
Had you been surfing the entire time?
No.
Okay.
No, it was not... During the time it was like the up until about 2005, I wasn't surfing often at all. Maybe 2-3 times a year.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, because I hadn't processed through that being something, and that was a big part of getting back into and winning the contest again. It was almost like, all right, I'm gonna go through this in order to give myself the ability to do it without that space of I have to do this. It's an obligation. It's a job. So it was almost like a let's do this again. Let's do it from a different space. And during the course of doing it my way, there was a lot of healing that was involved with that.
Mm-hmm.
It's so I felt, it felt like I was stepping into who I should have been as a competitive surfer.
Right.
Yeah. Corey's used her writing to openly criticize marketing tactics used to advertise surfing, as well as the ASP's policy towards women's surfing. I was curious to hear her thoughts on the new ownership of the ASP, Zoe Z, and the 2014 World Tour thus far.
Back in the early 2000s when everybody realized, oh my gosh, we can make a ton of profit off of this brand new market, which is women's surfing, they finally came to an aha moment with that. So they attached themselves to the surfers, but they were using models to promote the lifestyle, and it grew women's surfing to a place where, you know, you had the Dream Tour, and, you know, it was like the golden era for competitive surfing for women, Louis Anderson, Serena Brooke, all those girls, Megan Abubo, Kiala Kennelly, all rose up during that time, and even though they were being paid less, each incremental shift seemed like a huge, massive shift, and it was celebrated as such, not only by the women who were trying to, you know, if we celebrate this, if we positively reward the industry and our sponsors through the media, that, you know, we like this mm-hmm. is that hopefully it would encourage more growth for them as far as money and sponsorships and events. But the reality, as times have shifted and the economy has tanked, is that women would first want the chopping block. They're the first ones to lose their sponsorships. They're the first ones to lose their events on the ASP tour. So how much of their contribution to the giant growth of the surf industry in the 2000s had very little to do with how they're appreciated for their achievement. It was all, how much can we get out of the market, because we're marketing as a lifestyle rather than a more athletic deal.
Yeah.
So with the economic downturn of 2008, you saw all the loss of events for women, and that's pretty much when you started to see the hypersexualization start to come up with this new generation of women surfing better than ever, which any group of people even will surf better four generations in.
Sure.
Plus all of the technological advances. Mm-hmm. But because of the absolute limited historical connection that women have with their predecessors, mm-hmm. it's as if each generation of women is completely separated from the last. So the way that the surf industry treats men and women historically, where the men, they bring on Aki, they bring on all these guys, and they talk about, you know, the 1980 something something Bells Beach, and here are all the champions, and this is what they did, and they celebrate their history. They celebrate the men's history. They tie them to every generation that came before them.
Okay.
In the women's, they say this is how the women are better than the last generation. So they downplay. Except for one or two surfers, you'll always hear Lisa Anderson in there. Always,
right.
always. But it's almost as if there's really no other women who've come before that. And so there's not a celebration of the history of women's surfing.
Hmm.
There's just, this is how the new generation is faster, better, sexier, more beautiful.
Yeah, I've never thought of that. To me, like the way that I view that, just as a viewer without having thought about that detail of it, is just an embracing of what's to come. You know, I've never interpreted it as a, I don't know, like a pejorative of the old or
right.
what has come before. I just viewed it as, you know, embracing of what's to come. Do you think it's intentionally subjugating?
It's distinctly different from what
it
they
is
do with
distinctly
men.
Different.
Yeah.
yeah. But is it intentionally subjugating?
I don't think that they intentionally do anything. Well, I don't think that there's enough women involved in the leadership.
Yeah, I think that's true.
In order to say, look, this is the result, versus you may intend to constantly prop up,
mm-hmm.
but what you're doing is you're creating generation gaps
mm-hmm.
in setting the women's kind of historically up like this.
Yeah.
And when it's set up like that, each generation of women becomes the one that's heralded, but there's no celebration or lineage.
Yeah, what is the danger of that, do you think?
The danger is that there's no learning that happens. Each generation does the exact same thing that ended up crumbling the last one.
Okay.
So you see a repetition.
you always see repetition. Like, for instance, everybody's talking about, oh, the sexualization and hypersexual, and I'm a part of it. The very first women to go into that, there was one of the women in, she was in the 1970s. And then you had Wendy Botha in the 1980s. And now you have, and you know, the girls who are doing it now, Alana Blanchard, Anastasia Ashley, there's another one, Coffee, the name is.
Yeah.
And everybody's like, well, here's what's good and what's bad about it. And it's like, well, let's go back and take a look at Wendy Botha. Her Australian Playboy magazine was the first to sell out. And she's a four-time world champion.
Right.
She equals Freya Zamba and, you know, Lisa Anderson.
Yeah.
And the argument that's being made is, this will be good for women surfing. Sexualization and the beautification and focusing on will be good for women surfing. It didn't do them any good back then.
Right.
Because it's only tailored for one individual.
Sure.
So if we're not learning that, if we don't go back and take a look at that, I ask people all the time, do you know who Wendy Botha is? No.
Right.
It's happened before, but what happened then? What were the results then? Mm-hmm. Why don't we know this?
Mm-hmm.
And that's why.
Yeah.
So we're making the exact same mistakes. The girls are using the same arguments because they don't know their history. When you know your history, you can build off of that.
Right.
And what happens when you have a lineage is, like, for instance, everybody loves listening to stories of the heroics of guys back in the day, right? There's none of that in women's surfing. All it is a celebration of what it looks like.
Yeah.
And that continues to undermine the value of women's surfing. So the conversation doesn't, there's no valuing of it. Then if you want to increase the value of something, you have to deepen its roots in what is already the established, here's what we value, here's the stories, here's the heroics, so it stays this little, okay, well, we're gonna continue to keep it marginalized because we kind of have to and it's good for the market.
Yeah.
But there's no celebration of it.
Do you think that like currently, how do you feel the ASP is managing?
The 2014, the addition of those three?
Yeah.
I think this is an amazing step.
Okay.
But again, back to that, every incremental shift is seen as this massive, oh my gosh, we're celebrating women surfing. One of the articles that ESPN recently wrote about the new Zosi and what they're doing with women surfing, and Zosi themselves is saying, we're equalizing, we're bringing equality.
Right.
But when you have the winner of the men's WCT walking off with a $100,000 check, and you have the winner of the women's WCT walking off with a $60,000 check.
Right.
It's just rhetoric.
Right.
It's absolute rhetoric. I'm not saying that it's not a good shift.
Yeah.
But it's a facile, like, okay, well, you know, so here's what we're doing, but look at the WQS.
Right.
There are 12 women's events, 29 men's. So
right.
Is it just for show?
Right.
Because they are actually getting called out?
Yeah. There's so many topics to kind of unpack within each of these little things, but I'm kind of the opinion that it, as surfing, competitive professional surfing, as with kind of most sports, is just a meritocracy.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like the best athletes will get kind of paid the highest amount of money ultimately, and if the brands can find a way to market that, they're going to find those who are the most marketable. And it seems like with the male and female, like, there's open divisions in the NSSA, you know what I mean? And generally those are dominated by boys. Occasionally a girl surfer comes through and does compete in those and does really well. Saw that with Carissa Moore for sure. So I mean, like, that $100,000 prize check versus the $60,000 prize check, to me, is directly related to Kelly Slater's ability versus Carissa Moore's ability.
Right.
You know what I mean?
The problem with that concept,
yeah,
as with any idealization of America or any of the systems as a meritocracy, is that it completely disregards the fact that there's sexism, racism, and an inability to actually value something that's different. So if you've got the entire system corely, like, spaced around Kelly Slater as the top professional surfer,
right,
then everything else is judged according to that male form of surfing.
Mm-hmm.
If you're the best surfer in male surfing, it doesn't matter what you look like, you're going to be supported up through the ranks.
Right.
In women's surfing, if you don't have the sponsorship because you don't look a certain way,
sure,
you can't follow the tour in the WQS. So the concept of meritocracy doesn't even work. You don't excel through the ranks to even get to the top 17. because you don't have the sponsorships because you don't look the right way.
Right.
So how are you supposed to follow the tour that costs at least $40,000 to follow on the QS?
The following of the QS and the money that's involved and all that, those same challenges face the male surfers.
But there's
as
more
well.
Money in the men's.
There is, but there's also, I don't know the statistics, but I would argue there's a lot more men chasing those QS points than there are females. It might not be a proportionate amount of difference, but I think like the finding the sponsors challenge applies for the men as well. It's probably not as tied to looks, of course, as it is to the women or to appearance, you know, physical appearance. But I mean, there's obviously guys on tour right now that don't have main sponsors,
yeah. So
which is a challenge.
If your argument is that the more people there are, the more money there should be.
No.
Then Zosie's making the argument, and I agree, that it's about how much effort you put in to achieving what it is you want to achieve, rather than it being about the amount of people who are doing the activity. So if you have equal effort, then that effort should be rewarded equally.
Hmm.
And the way that whole like percentage of amount of people are shifted in the WCT is that there are 36 men and there are only 17 women.
Right.
So that's how that gets distributed.
Right.
And I understand the concept that since there's less women, there's a less percentage of money.
Yeah.
But that somehow equals, but it's still not.
I would rather the men's tour was 17 as well.
I totally agree.
You know
with
what
that.
I mean?
Totally.
We don't need the bottom whatever number is.
I think it'd make it much more exciting.
Totally.
Yeah.
Totally. So kind of back to that meritocracy kind of discussion though, like or ASP arguing that equal effort should result in equal pay. Is that the case though, if the equal effort doesn't result in the equivalent performance of surfing, for example?
Well, again, back to if you have only one way, and that's the only way, that's always, it depreciates the what other expressions get brought to it. But, so basically it would be like, well, why not put all the men and the women together and see who comes out on top? I think that's a pretty silly argument to make, because what it asks is, it asks women to be physically, strength-wise, equivalent to what the men are doing. And I think that nobody's going to make the argument that women and men surf exactly the same.
Right.
But that does not mean that what the women are now getting takes away from the men.
Right.
You know what I mean? It just asks that the women be treated the same as far as money goes, sponsorships, visibility. And I think that a lot of people, when they hear this conversation sometime, think that when you're talking about raising women up, that we're talking about pushing men down.
Yeah.
And that's just not the case.
Yeah.
It really isn't. It's just, let's value men and women the same way, which is, if you rip, then let's allow for a woman to rip and be celebrated without needing to plaster her ass everywhere.
Yeah.
That's all, I mean, that's pretty much the simplest part of the argument.
Mm-hmm.
So,
When you're hiring for a small business, you want to find quality professionals that are right for the role, and there's no faster or effective way than through LinkedIn Jobs. Your time and capital are precious, and there is a powerful resource that can help you focus on what you're good at and integrate people into your team seamlessly to help grow your business. LinkedIn Jobs has created the tools to find the right professionals for your team efficiently and for free. LinkedIn isn't just another job board. Everyone is already on LinkedIn with their resumes and references, and now LinkedIn has designed a hiring platform to connect you with candidates specifically qualified for the job that you post about. More than a billion professionals meticulously organized to connect people by skill set to help us all advance our position. 2.5 million businesses already use LinkedIn for hiring, and 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. It's that fast, easy to use, and effective. LinkedIn Jobs can help you write job descriptions, filter the right person to you, and give you the tools to help you interview them like a pro. linkedinjobs.com/surf is where you go to post your job for free. Yes, totally free. That's linkedinjobs.com/surf to post your job for free. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
I agree that the argument shouldn't be made that they should surf the same, or that Kelly Slater is what even female surfers should aspire to surf like. But I would also argue that they are, essentially, because even though they're in separate categories and competing separately, Carissa Moore or whoever is that's winning contests is essentially approaching surfing the same way that the guys who are winning on the men's side are.
Because that's what's celebrated. So okay. To my point of not being interested in competitive surfing anymore, because it completely flattens the creativity and innovation.
Right.
Even though that's one of those words that they throw out there as far as, for judging, we're going to score higher for innovation.
Right.
But the problem with that is the competitive environment doesn't even support that.
Sure.
So of course, in an environment that only values one type of surfing, everybody that's involved in it, men or women, mm-hmm. is going to be trying to do that thing, because that's how competition shapes your performance, your expression.
Yeah.
And that's so why I'm not interested in...
Are you interested in watching? I mean, do you watch the events now?
I still watch, but mostly to listen to what's being said.
Yeah.
To read YouTube comments, to see if... Because I've seen a very distinct difference between how the commentators spoke before Zosie came on board and said, "Look, we're gonna reframe the conversation around women surfing." Mm-hmm. So I've wanted to listen to how that has been reframed, and it's been reframed really well.
In what ways? What are their strengths this year, do you think?
This year, they're not talking about men's history while the women are surfing. They are actually giving more information about the women, other than, oh, she should have turned the here. She should have taken that wave. So there's a lot of advice being thrown out when they wouldn't do that with the men's mm-hmm. Prior. They have really focused on talking more about the history of the events and the winners mm-hmm. of the women, and creating stories that actually humanize the girls, the women. I think the thing that irked me the most is when you'd be watching the women's event, and then all of a sudden you'd have these guys start going off about the history of the event, the men's, and then talking story about, oh, do you remember this time when we were surfing together and competing? And I was like, dudes, come on now, you got the entire men's event to do that.
Yeah.
Bring up some interesting facts about these ladies.
Yeah.
Like, humanize them. Give their backstory.
Right.
Make them into something more than just a body out in the water that nobody cares about. If you care, other people will care too.
Sure.
That's what announcers are supposed to do.
Right.
And I think the one really, really big difference too has been the new commissioner, the women's manager.
Jessie Miley
Dyer. She's been doing an amazing job.
Yeah.
So Beck Woods.
Did the women have a female commissioner previously, or was it the men?
So check this. When I was living in Hawaii, when they first decided to block the women's CT off and create, like, okay, there's only top 12 or top 13 or just like something like that, I was at that meeting where that happened. And they also got a women's representative to be on board. Well, further on down the line, when Ling Beachley was on, was the women's representative, she actually was a part of the vote. If I have this correctly, she was a part of the vote that said, I don't need to be here. We don't need a women's representative. You guys go ahead and make decisions for us. Mm-hmm. So getting Jessie back on, I think it was 3 years ago, maybe two. It was the first time in a really long time that women had the voice.
Got it.
And if you actually read, for instance, Randy Rarick commenting about listening to women, he was like, oh, you've got to be really careful because, you know, just the stuff that he said was just, it was, oh, they're whiny and, You gotta be careful.
Temperamental or emotional. Just, I read that.
You did? Okay.
Yeah.
It was just
It seemed like it was taken from a past era. Like it was a quote that maybe he made in the 80s or something even, you know?
I think it was at that contest.
Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, so I'm really glad that Jess is on board. I'm glad that she got her law degree. So she's got
I didn't know that.
Shoulders. Yeah. Okay. And she doesn't get sponsored by any of the brands, and she's not surfing at the tour.
Right.
So she has at the absolute, you know, center space to stand for what mm-hmm. doing what's best for the women's tour, as well as having once been on tour.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So a lot of this competitive talk is kind of revolved around the way that female surfers are marketed. Can you talk about that a little bit and about how it's different for females than it is for males?
Sure. I think prior to this change with Zosi, because of the marrying of the brands with competitive surfing, there was some, and I think that was a part of the really, really obnoxious ads and commentary, because it was all, let's make women's surfing lifestyle, let's make men's surfing lifestyle, but more heroic, more focused on their action. It's mm-hmm. more aspirational for the men, whereas with the women, it's just, oh, just have this lifestyle. Do you know the difference?
Sure.
So with women, the way that they're presented is they might show some surfing, but it's always softened. And the way that it's softened is by a woman being presented as flirty, as being kind of giving that come hither look, playful. And it's not to say that surfing isn't that, but if it's constantly put out that way,
yeah.
then you're not going to take the athletes seriously.
Mm-hmm.
And social research has shown that if you, as well documented, that once you start to sexualize athletes, it completely turns off any viewer in thinking that they actually have ability. So if you've got brands over time who are constantly trivializing or sexualizing or objectifying the women that they're supposed to be sponsoring,
yeah.
they're creating this feeling in viewers, whether they're surfers, male or female, that, again, feeding into that, women shouldn't be valued for being athletes. They should just be valued for how they look.
Yeah.
And lightening up the surfing world. And you'll hear it today, even with ASP. The girls are just so playful, and they all get along, and she's always smiling, and they're so humble.
Yeah.
Because that's what needs, for whatever reason, that's what needs to be sold to the audience in order for the audience to not be intimidated by how well the girls are surfing.
Sure.
So, that's been true a long time. And I'm not gonna say that it's all the advertisers now. It's not all their fault. It's not all the media. It's not all the marketing. Because I think that once you've created an environment for so long, you end up getting girls who internalize it, and they come up and they say, I'm going to choose to do this. And I'm not saying that they're not choosing that. I think that they absolutely are.
Some are more than others, for mm-hmm. sure. What about, I also struggle, like, just as you're explaining some of it, I question, too, like, which came first in some scenarios, because I would like to think that if any of the female surfers went out, like, last year, I'll give you a specific example, John Florence doing that huge alley-oop in Bali, right,
that
he got a 10 for.
Yeah.
Like, I would like to think that if any of the female surfers went out and did something like that, that then that's how they might be marketed. And instead of the soft come hither, like whatever, I think if they go, I'm trying to think, like, let's say whatever brand sends girls down to whatever surf destination to do a surf trip, bunch of money's invested to go do product shoots and whatever. And if somebody stomps a giant alley-oop like that, I would like to think that they're gonna use that alley-oop as the main marketing material. And if they don't necessarily get that level of performance, that they then have to come back and figure out how to market the product, it might be, I don't know, easier or more valuable for the brand to market something other than, you know, the performance.
Right. Well, the misconception is that women don't want to see surfing, awesome surfing. That's your basic misperception. Because the brands are actually marketing to men. They're not marketing to what the women actually want. We mm-hmm. want to buy this stuff. So there's a marketing issue that exists with women surfing.
Okay.
Also, because the surf industry is a male-dominated world, that alley-oop, even it was I'll for instance leave a message.
Right.
Kenworthy.
Right.
And I got a chance to talk with Deb Friedman, who was the global marketing director of Nike during that whole thing. And she was like, "Don't you think it was done really, really well?" And I was like, "The surfing was amazing, but it got slaughtered by the fact that there's sumo wrestling in the sand. You were making this film for guys, not for girls. You were trying to convince the men that the girls rip so that there could be some respect there. But the reality is yeah, that needs to happen a little bit, but as soon as you introduce the whole lifestyle stuff, again, it's meant to go, these girls rip, but don't be intimidated."
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's actually kind of a slap in the face to guys, too. Like, oh, guys can't handle the fact that women rip? Mm-hmm. Like, that's such a scary thing? And the marketers think that.
Yeah.
And I don't think that that's true. Hmm. I think that there's so many men and women out in the water now that unless they're constantly being fed this like misogynistic crap, they're not gonna care if some chick rips as long as they respect each other in the water, as long
right.
as the girl doesn't, you know, completely cut them off.
Right.
I think that that's one of the great things about outside of the surf industry, marketing, competitive stuff. You paddle out in the water, if you give respect, you're gonna get respect.
Totally.
And so that's something that hasn't translated into the marketing world.
Yeah.
So I might have gone off on the question, but
no, it's okay.
But for me, and this is really important, for me the conversation about how women are represented very much is just as much about guys as it is about women. Because I just don't disrespect men enough to think that they don't have heads on their shoulders and minds.
Yeah.
I just don't. I don't think that makes sense in any way, shape, or form.
I think that there's equivalent examples with men in terms of lifestyle marketing, though.
Mm-hmm.
When you take surfers like Craig Anderson, you know, mm-hmm. and there'll be campaigns dedicated to him that show very little surfing.
Yeah.
And a lot of it is just drinking beer even, you know.
Yeah.
So what are your thoughts on that? You know, I mean...
Yeah. It's the industry itself not being interested in the performance anymore.
Yeah.
Because it's trying to reorient itself around the core. And the core... in the past was party, drink beer, don't give a fuck.
Right.
That's the way it was. So as this whole recession thing has happened and the free surfer has come up, which is this marriage between the I don't care about competitive
yeah.
surfing and the competitive surfer, that free surfer is supposed to capture what it used to be like. So it's nostalgia. And I think that the marketing of women has actually, because they've been pushed as lifestyle, has done the market and the industry so well that they've decided to do it to men too. And that the problem with the equivalency is the more you do it to men, like if you objectify or you know, just push the lifestyle of men, they have to, a lot of people think that, oh, well, if you just objectify and sexualize men, you do the lifestyle stuff with men too, like we've done with women, it'll even up, like it'll drop, and no, it doesn't. They get more, women get more and more sexualized. The men, you completely take away their being valued for performance.
Mm-hmm.
We live in a society that's doing that to men right now. And it has more to do with the objectification and the devaluing of human beings and their achievements. And that's the problem that comes through understanding why it's done to women.
Mm.
So I don't like it when it's done to guys either.
Yeah.
I think that it's BS. And the social research that I've done shows that, again, it doesn't matter if you're male or female, if you're sexualized, objectified, if it's just about you drinking beers, which I'm sure for Craig Anderson, there's enough video of him surfing.
Yeah.
Versus all these other girls who don't get any of it. And they're just seen as sexualized bodies.
Mm-hmm.
But if you do that to both men and women, the men are actually, the perception of their abilities is depreciated as well.
Mm-hmm.
It's across the board. It's not just a woman thing. It's
sure.
just that it happens more to women.
Right. I feel like those free surfer males, let's say professional free surfer males, who have made a career out of it, nobody gifted them that career, obviously. They linked up with a filmer and or paid the filmer and went out, produced edits, got a sponsor based on the quality of those edits.
Yeah.
Why isn't that more common for the female surfers, you know? Sage Erickson isn't on tour anymore, so she's probably free surfing a lot more, and I've seen her little video clips on Instagram, you
right.
know? But I haven't seen her put together a 3-minute clip and put it up on Vimeo like Nick Rosa did
right.
a couple years ago to get a sponsorship back from Reef, you
right.
know?
Because an audience hasn't been cultivated that appreciates women surfing.
Yeah.
I think that we're right at the very point, the crux of the point where that's going to start being the case. The best marketing of anybody out there right now for the women's surfing, not the image of women surfing, but women surfing, is the ASP.
They're doing the best job, or they have the best potential to do?
They are doing the best job. Okay. And I'm talking about like split second between the heat, sort of like we have seen strength and beauty.
She
and
is,
I mean, and not that it needs to be, because I know they're trying to do the whole gladiator thing, but but I mean, like, they're showing surfing. So I think that right now, with the split from the brands and Zosie and everything that's going on this year, I think that we are starting to see the beginning of the cultivation of an appreciation for women surfing. And I think that in the future we will see that same dynamic. Mm. So I think, and that's why I'm super interested just to continue to pay attention.
Yeah.
Because I think that if we continue down this path, we're heading in some really great territory.
Yeah. Let's talk about a couple female surfers specifically. I'll tie it in to what you were just talking about. Like, let's say Alana Blanchard, right?
Mm-hmm.
The most obvious kind of poster girl. I don't know her personally, but I would like to think that at some point in her career development, when she was young, kind of aspiring pro surfer, she might have realized, like, 9 out of 10 times, Carissa Moore is going to beat me in a contest. So my opportunities to be a world champ might be limited. There is this other path for me, you know, of bikini shots on Instagram, which wasn't a thing at the time, but it is now for her, a really big thing.
Yeah.
What is the danger for her in kind of, like, look, maybe I can make more money than Carissa Moore will as a world champ. I won't be a world champ, but it's easier work. I'll still get to see the world. I'll also still get to travel the world and surf and probably improve my surfing given the travel opportunities that I have by, you know, objectifying myself essentially. But she personally is okay with objectifying herself.
Sure.
What are the challenges? What's the...
Well, I'll start back to a comment that she actually made.
Okay.
Which was Rip Crow was taking her on photo shoots and she didn't like it at first.
Okay.
She was uncomfortable with it. But it kept happening and they kept asking. So then she gave in.
As like a pre-18-year-old, pre-adult, or...?
I'm not sure what age she was. Yeah. So you've got the dynamic set up where the industry comes to your sponsor, the only money that you have.
Right.
And basically says, we want you to do this. And you know that if you don't, what happens? So
who's
right,
your
okay.
sponsor?
So, that happened. So that happened.
Yeah.
And then what ends up happening is cognitive dissonance, which is, I'm going to embrace this. I'm going to embrace it so much that I'm going to become the biggest proponent of this particular brand of marketing myself in surfing.
Mm-hmm.
The challenges to that are, first of all, we have to separate that Alana Blanchard is doing anything good for women surfing. She's not. She's doing something good for herself.
Right.
And I can't fault her for that. I don't think anybody can stand there and go,
sure,
wag your finger.
Right.
Because it's her personal choice.
Yeah.
And a lot of girls actually look at that, see the over 880,000 followers that she has on Instagram, more than anybody else.
Yeah.
Including Kelly Slater.
Right.
And because of the way that we appreciate people now, it's all about Twitter followers and likes and fame. So she becomes appreciated for the image that she creates and puts up. If that's what she wants.
Which seems to be the case.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Then that's, and she's all for it now.
Right.
Back to the whole, like, okay, well, I've decided to do this, so I'm going to do it 100%. Cognitive dissonance. And that's what happens sometimes. But I'm not going to say that she's, you know, lying to herself or anything like that. I don't want to devalue another female that way.
Yeah.
But I also don't think that there was an environment that was actually made available to her where she was actually choosing.
Mm-hmm.
That there was a real choice there.
Sure.
You know, it was a choice of either do this or go.
Yeah.
Right? And that's what a lot of us experience when we're in these situations.
Mm-hmm.
It's a false choice. So I think the problem is that there's a narrowly defined idea of success now in surfing and what it looks like. I'm really, really proud of Carissa Moore for standing up and on Surfer Magazine and saying, this is something that other women have chosen. I'm not going to choose to go in this direction. And so now there becomes this polarized way of being. There's the Carissa Moore, Carissa Moore way of being, and now there's the Alana Blanchard way of being. Mm-hmm. And so now you've got a whole two different pathways for women to take.
Sure. It seems like there's more than Carissa, though, too, on her kind of side of the ledger.
There are, but there's still only two ways of being for women surfers.
Sure.
It's completely narrowly defined. And so that's the thing that I would really love to see, is just for the whole thing to break open and for it not to be, oh, there's this one type and then there's this other type and that's all we have.
Yeah.
Because that's always been the way that it is, only those two types. One type has always been the sexualized.
Right.
The other type has sort of shifted a little bit through time.
Yeah.
But it's always been a fully achievement or fully sexualized. Mm-hmm. And that's just, I mean, it's just so narrow and so limiting. Mm-hmm. Whereas I look over at the guys and I'm like, geez, you know, there's this guy and this guy. He looks different and he's doing this and what's going over here? It's just so much more diversity is celebrated.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And if you're growing into what you do as a kid, you grow into what you look at and what you want to be. Mm-hmm. That gives you two options as a woman.
Yeah. Is there any value at all, I guess, in kind of the sexualization of Anastasia Ashley, for example?
Right.
You know, like, I mean, and the reason why I ask that is because it seems like with Kelly Slater, for example, he's a gorgeous human being, you mm-hmm. know, and a lot of that, I think that's benefited his career in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. And you're absolutely right in that the focus has been more of his surfing than it has been anything else.
Sure.
But it's undeniable that his looks certainly probably got him a lot farther with Quicksilver, you know,
sure.
in the beginning. So, I mean, I guess let me kind of back up.
But the problem here is that you're trying to compare apples and oranges.
Yes, I am, for sure.
Because and even if you were to do it with any guy.
Yeah.
Because there's a history of what happens when women are sexualized
yeah.
and objectified.
Right.
Which, no matter how much you sexualize a man, there's no victimization of that man.
Right.
There's not a history of...
There's no plight of that.
Right.
Yeah.
And not only that, but if you take, and if you look at, go back to the research, if a woman is sexualized, all the functions stop working. Mm-hmm. Like, there's this really great experiment that happened where they had men and women go in and, okay, we're going to give you a math test, but can you wear this in the meantime? Guys put on trunks, women put on bathing suits. The women's aptitude completely tanked. The men's didn't affect them at all.
Just from wearing the bikini.
Just from wearing the bikini.
Yeah.
Just from being, and there was a mirror in front of them. Just from being completely engaged with, oh my gosh, I'm... Mm-hmm. This is my experience of my body right now. Mm-hmm. And so it's a completely different set of problems.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Totally.
So as far as there being a positive to the sexualization, it's very limited, mm-hmm. and it's money and it's success for a very short period of time for that one individual. Mm-hmm. What it does to people watching, the young girls, what it sets up as far as what sexualization does to other women, it's literally tied to three of the most severe problems that women have to tackle in general: eating disorders, body anxiety, depression. It's directly tied to that. So at the expense of everybody, these women are saying, I'm going to find my success. We celebrate this in this culture now.
Mm-hmm.
There, where it's no longer is the conversation, I'm going to do the best for my peers, the best thing that I can do in order to support my peers. What I'm going to do is find the best possible thing for me, no matter how short of a period of time it is. Two different ways of thinking.
Yeah.
Just two different modes of thinking. But for somebody who's in that position to stand up and say, this is really what I think I'm doing to better women surfing.
Yeah.
It's complete bullshit.
Yeah.
They may think that.
Right.
But it's not, it's...
It's a very short-term view.
And it's not true.
Yeah.
Like, they're not doing anything. So...
Let me ask you this. The way those brands are marketing, I know you've, I guess, made a case that it is geared more for men than it is for women.
The male gaze, yeah.
How would you then market that product for a female?
Sure.
You know, what would the alternative be?
I would look at Sia, which is an all-women's clothing company.
Yeah.
It's doing some amazing things. Tallow is doing amazing things.
And what are they doing?
They're presenting women, still the lifestyle shots, but there's a completely different way of showcasing women that shows them as active. Like, for instance, you don't chop off their heads and just show their body trunk.
Right.
small things like that, instead of showing women barely surfing and then just throwing in some fun or jumping, playing on the beach, mm-hmm. you really capture the surf of the women at the same time as you're presenting stylized and very creative shots. My solution is support the smaller brands who are getting all their stuff stolen by the bigger brands right mm-hmm. now, and they're constantly going to battle with these guys with lawyers. It's just ridiculous. Support the smaller brands, identify the ones that are invested in positive images, and then get more women into the leadership of these companies. Not women who have been brought up within the industry, but women who come from outside, mm-hmm. who actually understand this can be really, really solid and really good for drawing more customers in, because the companies aren't interested in the audience that already exists.
Right.
What they're interested in is drawing in new customers.
Yeah.
And they're going into international markets now, where they're not gonna understand, like for instance, Chinese, Indian, they're not gonna understand these sexualized images. So they have to shift their marketing anyway. So it's not like, oh, we just can't afford to. It's just like, well, you're already going into these places where you're gonna have to rethink everything. So rethink it in a way where you can present something across the board that's not gonna, offend or degrade anybody.
Mm-hmm.
But it will be like a lot of women in these places, I want to be a strong woman. Mm-hmm. Not I wanna be the object of somebody's desire.
Yeah.
That's what surfing is. When you go out there, you're not going out there to be the object of somebody's desire. You're going out there to engage with something that's a massive undertaking.
Right.
And that's the way it should be represented.
Yeah. Are there independent, you know, projects that have come along that you've seen that have...
There's some potential. I'm telling you, the people who I've been speaking with lately, as far as, like, there's nonprofits that are starting to emerge everywhere. There's women's product lines that are starting to pop up everywhere. And it's because everything's become so polarized. Mm-hmm. It's like, it's almost as if the hypersexuality needed to happen in order for these other women to finally go, you know what? It's time to show a different way of being.
Yeah.
And
that happens, I think, just in...
In general.
Yeah, in society. There's always an anti-movement for every movement.
But it's interesting because it's not an anti. Everybody that I've been speaking to is like, we don't want to just stand in opposition. We want to create what it looks like, what our vision of it is.
Right.
So what's really cool about it, and this is where I'm at right now, because I've stood for the last 3 years and picked apart, deconstructed. I'm gonna show you where everything's wrong. And I'm at this place now too where I'm like, okay, it's time to move from opposition to the creation of something. And that's the most exciting thing that I'm involved with and that I'm seeing from these other women as well, is they've stepped into the it's time to create.
Yeah.
And all of us are very careful because we know that the thing that gets created is the thing that gets sucked back up into the thing that is already present.
Totally.
So we're actually all bonding across the line, reaching out to each other and creating a network that's just as, so all of these individuals, so just as large as the industry itself. So you might be able to pluck one person and pull them in, idea and pull them in, but if it's a unity.
Yeah. Do you want to talk about what you're creating or?
I can mention what I'm working on. It's called the Inspire Initiative. And my first event is going to be this Saturday. And then also there's an Institute for Women Surfers that's going to happen this summer. And that is going to be the start of...
What's the Inspire Initiative?
It's my nonprofit.
What is it?
Okay, so describe it. I'll wait.
Okay,
wait. But it's not just my thing. I've been speaking with a lot of women actually around the world who are like, oh my gosh, this is so weird. Synchronicity, we're all doing the same
thing.
Yeah,
like, yeah.
So,
yeah. Yeah.
See your heart as a rhythm.
I think, like, people always say, obviously, like, if you do something that you love, you never have to work a day in your life, sort of cliche, you know? And, like, I found that not to be true necessarily because it ends up just being something else that you hate waking up and going to do.
Yeah.
It seems like at different times in your life, maybe surfing has represented that.
Yeah.
Or competitive surfing, anyways.
Yeah, I don't think
In hindsight, is there anything that you would have done differently?
I wish that I would have found my voice earlier.
Okay.
That's definitely something that I wish. I wish I would have been less concerned about what other people thought. But at the same time, I appreciate that everything that I experienced was because I was trying to fit into something.
Mm-hmm.
And, but I wish I would have been less concerned about what other people thought.
Yeah.
I wish I would have been okay with making mistakes and being imperfect.
Can you tell me about Out in the Lineup?
Yeah.
The film?
Yeah.
Can we talk about that?
Sure. It's been so, so warmly received by everybody. We just won the jury selection for Best Action Film Award up in Newport.
Okay. Oh, at that film festival.
Against Five Summer Stories.
Yeah.
All right, so it's like the timing of it is really awesome. We just sold out the San Diego Surf Film Festival, the first block to sell out. I mean, it's being really, really warmly received. And
explain what the film is.
Okay. Basically, it follows a gentleman by the name of David Wakefield and Thomas Castets. Thomas created GaySurfers.net,
okay.
Which is sort of how all of us came together, was through him creating that website, because he couldn't find anything but really bad porn by typing in GaySurfers.
No way.
So, and David found him through that. David hadn't come out yet. He was playing the piano at his local church and just kind of quietly going about his business. He was a state champion in Australia at one point. So it follows him kind of his adventure and coming out a little bit.
Okay.
And in the process, traveling around to like Ecuador, they came here. They went to Hawaii, around Australia. But they have conversations with different gay surfers in different places. A lot of free surfers, which I absolutely adore. I adored reconnecting with people who are just free surfing. And that's almost like there's a tone of here's the free surfers, and then mm-hmm. here's the surfers who have had to experience the industry, and what mm-hmm. they're, you can't help but notice the difference.
Sure.
So it just tells some stories. It kind of humanizes gay surfers in a way that hasn't happened, and it speaks about our different experiences. We each get to share our different experiences and how very different they have been.
Yeah.
And it's definitely a hopeful message at the end too. So it kind of it tracks through the problem, goes through the challenges, but then it also ends on a really positive and upbeat note.
Sweet.
Yeah.
Is the movie available for purchase currently, or available
you can
to
rent,
view?
You can view it online.
Okay.
Go to outinthelineup.com.
Okay.
You can rent it $6.99 on Vimeo.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cool. Surfing has become a lot for you, more than just an act, obviously. It's become a platform and kind of a catalyst for things. Has any of your kind of political activism changed your enjoyment of the act of surfing?
No. No. Because now it's the thing, I guess there's still a part of me that's separated from it, right? So there's the surfing, but now I've been able to reconnect with the surfing as, you know, like when I was a kid and I loved it. Now the competitive side is the activist side. And so the trophies and the, it's almost as if, okay, so I married the two and then watched them do this again.
Mm-hmm.
So that, I now feel like I have the ability to change things with that side instead of just being a victim of it.
Right.
And so.
Interesting.
It has really shifted on that side. And the surfing side is just when I paddle out in the water, I don't want to talk to anybody. I'm not chatty. I don't need to sit. It's not social hour. I don't care if it's junk.
Yeah.
But I'm gonna enjoy myself.
Yeah.
Because that's what I'm there to do. So, and that's, again, for me, talking about the competitive side and all of that, it's distinctly different from surfing.
Yeah.
So when I'm talking about, like, people out in the lineup, totally different. This is a whole different, what's going on over there.
Yeah.
Competitive surfing could end tomorrow. It could fall apart, fall into the ocean, or blow up. This is still going to be here.
Yeah.
All of our relationships, all of our love for it.
that leads me actually to my next question, which is, has any of your stance on, I mean, you've been pretty vocal about things, and it is, I think people either completely agree with you or completely disagree with you, especially on the internet.
Yeah.
So has that jeopardized, have you lost any relationships because of that, or?
No.
Do you regret any, no?
No. You know, I had to go through a, not that I'm aware of, but I don't think that people are really good at saying things to my face. It might be good standing behind an anonymous sort of moniker and doing whatever, but I've found that, you know, like, we can disagree. It's like political disagreements. It's like, yeah, but the nice thing about political disagreements is at least you're talking about it.
Right.
At least there's conversation being started.
Totally.
I've had people, I think, completely disagree with me, but then they just kind of quietly go talk about me behind my back or to somebody else, which to me is very cowardly. It's like, if you have an issue, like, let's just talk.
Right.
But at the same time, I don't value people who don't know how to
communicate
face to face.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? What I do value is people who know why they believe what they believe.
Yeah.
I had to learn because of that, not wanting to be publicly divisive from growing up, always wanting to publicly please, be a yes person. I had to learn how to take criticism. I had to learn how to have people disagree with me, and I had to learn the difference between a real disagreement, a real argument, and something that was just, I'm going to be mean.
Right.
Or it was based in a really weird sort of logic that came from, I don't even know. And then, of course, when you're online, you have to just learn how to surf the trolls.
That's a whole different dynamic that we're all still learning.
Yeah.
I mean, it's
the
new thing.
Yeah. But I also think that surfing is ready for conversations like this. I believe that the surf audience can actually engage in these conversations without it taking away from their joy and their love of surfing. And I think that it's the renaissance that we're going through right now has nothing to do with technological advances. It has nothing to do with machinery, fabrics, or the industry. What it has to do with is a socio-political awareness. And I truly believe that with all the stuff that's going on around us. And so if somebody hates me because of my stance, they're either going to listen or they're going to shut me off. But
yeah.
I'm not going to be quiet because I'm afraid somebody's not going to like me. I'm just not.
Yeah. What is your current surf schedule now? Like, how often are you surfing?
In the spring, summertime, I haven't been surfing too much during the winter. It's like I hit late December, January, and I'm like, I can't do it.
Yeah.
I'll surf like 3 to 4 times a week.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you get to travel any longer for surfing?
Mm-mm.
Not so much?
No, but that's all right.
Yeah.
As long as it's an ocean.
Yeah. We always have waves in Southern California, marginal waves. Final question for everybody is, what's the last board that you rode, and when was it?
Okay, well, the last board that I rode was a 5.5 used Almeric DFR.
Oh, really?
And then prior to that was a 9.3 Ashley Lloyd.
Okay.
Speed Stickle.
A lot of range between those two boards.
Yeah.
Cool. Thanks.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you.
Thank you, David.
Yeah, of course.
Corey Schumacher's website, which she updates regularly with her commentary on all things surfing, can be found at coreyschumacher.com. Episodes of Surf Splendor can be found on our website, surfsplendorpodcast.com, where everything is archived for free. If you listen to this show in iTunes or Stitcher, make sure to rate and review the show. That increases our rankings and helps grow the show. And I insist, if you enjoy listening to this show, then you want it to grow. The more listeners we have, the more shows we are able to produce. You are our only form of advertising, so please be sure to share the show with your friends. You can do so via social media, where you can find us at Surf Splendor. Thank you, Corey Schumacher, for challenging convention. Thank you, our listeners, for sharing the show. And we will be back next week. This is David Scales for Surf Splendor saying, until next time, aloha. Free speech, lipstick.